This is Shutters Inc. with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 333 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from ShuttersIncPodcast.com, and joining me via Skype from the middle of Victoria once again, David Marland. Welcome.
G'day, Bruce. How are you going?
Good, mate. And you?
Oh, I'm doing all right. I'm feeling a bit paranoid, though.
Why?
Well, we had a really lovely episode last week with Rob Coates. What a lovely guy. Oh. But then got started to talk about whether one should back up your photos, and I'm getting worried.
Okay, yeah.
I think of this as a bit of a couch, and I'm climbing onto it to get a bit of advice because, you know, I'm David Marlin, I'm a photographer, and I haven't backed up my photos for an hour.
Oh, right. Okay. So do you have a good backup regime?
I have a backup regime. I have, like you, I have some spare discs in the house, and about once a week I back those up, and then I have another lot in another place, and about once a month or once every 2 months I back those up as well. And that's it. They're both in fireproof boxes.
Wow.
So, well,
you're probably the first guy I've ever heard of who's actually following all the rules.
Well, I don't necessarily follow them strictly.
Yeah, right.
But
man, that's a good
boxes,
start.
You can get them at Aldi.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They come up every so often. They're about $40.
Wow. And what size box?
It's enough to hold a decent wad of A4. So you can put three or four hard drives. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So keep an eye out for them.
I will keep an eye out for them. That's a good tip. I'd never even considered the possibility that a fireproof portable case might actually even be a thing that you could buy. So, no, that's worth knowing because, you know, if I could pick up something like that, then, you know, the four or five hard drives that are sitting, you know, 6 feet from me in the cupboard could be inside one of those boxes, and that would at least be just an extra layer of protection.
Yeah, and they're at a pretty reasonable cost, you know.
Yeah.
Actually, it's a return job because a few years ago you talked about those Pelican-like cases.
The Craftwrite cases from Bunnings,
I've got a few of those. They're fantastic.
They are great. I picked up one after Glenn told me about them, and I've got all my flashes and my flash triggers and, you know, various off-camera flash paraphernalia in that case, so... Yeah, no, they're a handy little box to have. And again, they were only about $39 or $40, I think, at the time.
Yeah, they're still sort of available every so often. I just wander past that part.
Yep.
Just in case I get another dose of gas and I want to buy some more gear. It needs it. Speaking of gear, that Lytro was interesting. Do they give away a free Cray supercomputer with it?
You'd be wanting something pretty hefty, wouldn't you?
Oh, goodness, that was amazing. Actually, it explains something else I've noticed down here. The trouble with Crays is you can't find them in the fish shops anymore.
No.
Oh, sorry. That was terrible.
That was shocking.
We need to improve.
So what have you been up to in the last 3 weeks or 4 weeks since we spoke with you?
Photographically, not a lot. I actually had a few weeks off, and I did a lot of stuff around home, all the catching up, the going from summer to winter stuff. But it's been a bit too dry to get around too much around the Grampians and that.
Why would dry be a problem?
Snakes.
Ah. They'll leave you alone if you leave them alone.
That's all right, but when you're blundering through bush that's about shin high, it can be a bit tricky.
And you're out there at stupid o'clock.
Sorry?
And you're out there at stupid o'clock.
Out there at stupid o'clock by yourself. Yeah, you just got to be careful.
All you got to do is just wear heavy boots and thump hard on the ground as you walk, and they'll get out of your way.
It's the hand and foot climbing that's a bit tricky.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
But we did go to Warrnambool. I hadn't been down to the Apostles for many years.
Right.
And it was wall-to-wall people.
Right.
But the thing I saw that was crazy was that there's a place there called the Grotto.
Right.
And essentially you go down a lot of steps and then from, you get a view through a cave, which is just a, like a bridge, through to the ocean, and there's a drop of about 20 or 30 feet or about 20 to 30 metres past where you're asked to stop.
Right.
And that's where the sea is. And there were some tourists, though definitely not Australians, who were over the safety fence. They had their backs to the water.
Oh.
Now, the water's well down, but you're talking about the Southern Ocean here.
Yeah.
And two of them posed just as the swell went up, and within half a metre behind them, there was a vertical wall of 3 to 4 metres of water.
Jesus.
They were so lucky. And what the pleasing part about it was that there are other people with me in behind the safety fence.
Yeah.
And you had plenty of opportunity to take good shots, and they were young people, and they were saying, these guys are bloody idiots, you know.
Yeah.
And they didn't get a good reception when they came back. We yelled out and said, hey, everyone wants to take photos here. Get out of the way.
Yeah.
But it was just – it's just that stupidity of people.
Yeah.
I think if they've got a camera in their hand, they're bomb-proof or something like that.
Yeah.
We're at Milford Sound last year.
Yep.
And a lady had decided to step over the fence at the chasm, and it's called that for a reason.
Right.
Take a selfie.
Yep.
And when we got there, the car park was being cleared as the helicopter was coming in to pick her up.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, we don't have special writers, photographers, and, yeah. So that was my main experience, I'm afraid. What about yourself? What's been happening last
week? Photographically, not much. Actually, Anzac Day, had the camera out on Anzac Day because Max was marching with the cadet unit that he's a member of at the entrance here on the Central Coast. The entrance generally has quite a well-organized parade and ceremony on Anzac Day every year. So, and for the cadet unit, it's kind of like their real moment of, I guess, being public,
right?
You know, for the year. You know, the majority of the time, it's, you know, Friday nights on the cadet base at Erina, you know, which is, you know, all behind barbed wire fence kind of stuff. And Anzac Day is kind of the only time that they're really out in public and visible to the public. And I know that, you know, the lady that I've been liaising with inside the cadet unit, I don't know if I've really told this story on the podcast, but I've kind of fallen into this role as the unofficial official photographer for the ACU for this particular unit. And it all came about because last year there was they do a cadet competition day.
Right.
And basically, there are different cadet units all up and down the Central Coast. I think there's about 8 units in our region. And they all come together at this, you know, in this particular instance, it was at a high school ground. I think it must have been about September of last year. And they do all the sorts of stuff that they train for as cadets.
Right.
But they do it in a competitive nature. So, they're marching and they're, you know, drilling and doing all the things that they do, and they're marked and judged according to how well they do it. And so I'd, you know, taken my camera along and spent most of the day with a 70 to 210 on, you know, because it was all, you know, they were a fair distance away. And I posted those photos on Facebook afterwards and I tagged Max in them. And this lady, Kate, who's part of the cadet unit, she obviously saw she's obviously friends with Max because she's part of the cadet unit and Max is a member of the cadet unit. And so because he was tagged in them, she then got to see these photos. And next thing I know, I'm getting a message from her via Max saying, hey, Dad, you know, this Kate wants to talk to you about photography. And
it's sort of that wants to talk to you.
Yeah. And so I said, yeah, you know, she can give me a call anytime. Yeah. So she gave me a call and she, you know, she said, oh, wow. She said, I didn't know we had such a competent photographer amongst our parents, you know. And I said, oh, well, thank you, you know. And she said, you know, would you, you know, mind doing photography for us every now and again if we were to ask. And I was like, yeah, no, that's fine, you know. So so although it's, you know, it's not an official, you know, quote unquote role, yep. I'm sort of the unofficial official photographer, if you like.
Good. Yep, yep.
So, you know, so I ended up getting dragged in to do the, you know, the end of year march out parade and then their formal dinner at the end of year. And yeah, and so I've just sort of fallen into that role without any planning or without having, you know, tried to angle myself in there or anything like that. And so Kate had said to me, she said, you know, Anzac Day is really, you know, that's the big one for us, you know, because we're out in public. And so, yeah, so that was the time to get the camera out in the last week or so. For our listeners outside of Australia and New Zealand, Anzac is the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps, and the name originates from our Army's combined forces during World War One, and we suffered a horrific defeat at Gallipoli in 1915, and we were fighting the Turkish, and the Turks to this day will tell you that our combined forces fought very bravely under absolutely awful odds. It was an absolute massacre, and yeah, so we recognise this day on the 25th of April every year as Anzac Day, and there's generally, you know, I don't think there are any guys left from World War One now. I think they've all passed away now. But yeah, generally our returned servicemen all march, and yeah, so for those outside of Australia and New Zealand, that's a very quick history on what Anzac Day is all about. Yeah, so that's a very long way of answering what have I been doing lately.
Well, I noticed, unfortunately, with the Canadian fires, a town of Anzac is under threat.
Oh, there is and a town called Anzac?
It's called Anzac in Canada, in Alberta, and it's called that because during the war, obviously as part of training for engineers, they surveyed a railway there, and the town was named after the Australian-New Zealand troops that were there.
Wow.
Doing that as part of their exercise. So that's under the threat. But,
wow, I'd never heard that.
Yeah, I've just picked it up on the news tonight.
But yeah, right.
Tell me, with all that variety of things with the cadets, what's the most challenging part, you know, photographically to do?
I think for me, what I find challenging is just the fact that I very rarely do stuff where I don't have much time to get it right.
Right.
And, you know, any type of live event like that is very much one of those scenarios where you've absolutely got to, you know, nail focus in a split second kind of thing. And for me, that's my struggle. And the problem with the parade ground at the cadet unit is, although there's a couple of really tall light towers with, you know, really, I don't know, probably 500-watt spotlights on top, but, yeah, they're 20 metres up in the air kind of thing.
Yep.
They don't throw a lot of light. Like, it's plenty for the naked eye.
Yeah.
But for a camera that struggles beyond 1800 ISO, it's actually not a lot of light. So I always find that I'm, you know, having to shoot at least 800. And sometimes, you know, as the sun goes down and it actually does get quite dark, you feel like you need to step it up to 1600 at times, which I don't like doing. So, yeah, so that's another one of the reasons why I'd love a camera that had slightly better, you know, low light performance. But, yeah, I think, you know, just getting focus fast and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And because I don't use TTL flash, I dial my flash in manually. You know, that's also a challenge as well, you know, making sure that I'm not overexposing or underexposing, because you're generally only getting one shot at everything. So
you've sort of got to set up a field of view, or like a trap in a way, so that when people step into it. And, yeah, those overhead lights can be very deceptive, like at footy training or something like that. You think they're right, but from a camera's perspective, you're sort of saying, oh, well, it'd be pretty all right. 200 ISO, no problem, and you're going, my God, it's a 30-second exposure.
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, missed.
Yeah. So, yeah. Now, through the week, I received an email from a guy called Ian Reed, who I've not heard from before, and this was via the comments on shuddersincpodcast.com. He said, again, thanks for the show. I, for one, cannot wait for the On One RAW processor. I use Lightroom for my RAW processing and have done so since its original iteration as RAW Shooter Professional. But even on my highly spec'd Windows box, it is slow. I also have and use On One Photo 10, and it loads and previews way faster. Even though it currently processes RAW files, it first converts them to huge PSD files. The new software promises to do away with that, and it promises to fully utilize your graphics processing card. I cannot wait. Sorry about the shouting, but Adobe needs a giant kick up the bum.
Well, his comments about Lightroom seem to be fairly common. I mean, I use Lightroom and I find it a bit slow.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And even though I've pushed the computer a bit.
Just out of interest, what are your specs on your PC?
Oh, I'd have to go back. I built it about a year or so ago.
Right.
But I've got, I use a 200 odd gigabyte SSD.
Yep, and, for your operating system.
Yeah, in my operating system. And the Lightroom allow you a maximum of 75 gigabytes in the cache, and I do that.
Right.
But it's still a bit on the slow side to render some of the JPEGs when looking at the RAWs.
Wow.
Just at times it just decides to be a bit sluggish. And a few people are having that. Maybe it's trying to do too much.
You're talking about generating the previews?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's once the previews are generated, it's not too bad.
I was going to say, do you have it set to automatically generate the previews when you import?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but I mean, the other one is it also makes you sit and think and look at the photograph. I mean, some people want to, you know, put them out like sausages in a machine.
Yeah.
But I like to take a bit of care about selecting them and then working on them.
Right.
One at a time. So it's, to me, it's not so bad. If I was a professional looking to run through, you know, two or three wedding shoots in a week, well, that might be something quite different.
Right. How much RAM have you got?
16 gig.
Yeah, right.
So it's not too bad. It's an i7. So I just can't remember which, whatever.
Yeah. I'm similar. And mine's an AMD-based system that, again, I built myself.
Yep.
But, yeah, likewise, you know, 16 gig of RAM and 4 gig octa-core processor and running on an SSD for the operating system. I don't find Lightroom to be that slow, other than, as you say, generating the previews can be a little bit sluggish. What size RAW files are you working with?
The 7D puts them out at about 20 to 25.
Megabytes?
Yep.
Right. So what's the megapixel count of that camera?
Oh, I'd have to go and have a look. Whatever the 7D spec is.
Mark what?
Mark one.
Right.
Don't know.
Yeah, interesting.
I bought it. I've got it, so I want to do the best with it. I'm not worried about the stickies after that.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough.
Actually, that reminded me the thing that Rob said I thought that was really good.
Yeah.
Rather than looking at upgrading all the time, but trying to get the most out of the camera he has before he thinks of upgrading. I thought that was a pretty good comment.
Yeah. Well, I try and live by that philosophy as well. You know, for a long time have said, you know, no, there's no need for me to upgrade my camera. I haven't extracted everything I really can and should, you know, from the A850. And I'm only getting to a point now where I'm starting to feel, you know, itchy feet to move on simply because of the low light performance. And I see, you know, all the new stuff coming out and I know how much better it does with low light than, you know, my 850 does.
But you're looking at it for a need you have rather than a need you think you might have.
Rather than?
A need you think you might have.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It is a need that I genuinely do have.
Enjoy shopping.
Yeah. Well, to go shopping, I need to have money.
So, a slight problem.
Yeah. Yeah, so anyway. Yeah. I heard from Rakesh via Facebook through the week, and he sent me a link to Canon's Vivid web page because Canon are the major sponsors for the Vivid Festival in Sydney. And this has a basically just a list of all the different events and things that are going on at Vivid this year. In fact, I actually think he sent me this last week, and because he sent it to me as a private message on Facebook, it wasn't posted on the Facebook Shutters Inc. wall, I inadvertently forgot about it last week, and I really should have had it up last week because Vivid starts this weekend, which will be the weekend that this podcast comes out. So if anyone is interested in any of the stuff going on at Vivid, check out the link that'll be in the show notes. There's a few different workshops that are paid. There's a few things that are free. And of course, you know, if you're down there at nighttime, you can always take lovely photos from the harbour of, you know, the buildings and the Opera House all lit up with weird and wonderful colours and patterns and lights. So, yeah, that link will be in the show notes for anyone who wants to check that out.
That helicopter flight looks pretty good. You get to play with an 1DX Mark II.
Right.
It includes use of an EOS X 1DX Mark II, use of a gyro, so SD card, and A3 print.
That's the new flagship? Is it the 1DX Mark II? Is that a new camera?
I think it might be. But it's, $450. And knowing the price of choppers, that probably gives you 10 seconds in the chopper.
I was going to say, yeah, there wouldn't be a lot of flight time in that.
No, but it's probably up and over.
Presumably, they'd go up in, you know, something that can carry a pilot and three passengers. So they should be doing okay out of each flight.
Well, there was some when we New Zealand Glaciers. It was $200 a head. And there were six people in it. It was $300 a head. That was for half an hour.
What? Wow. We were in New Zealand. Oh, when was that? That was 2010, I think it was. We went on a cruise, yep. And when we were in Tauranga for a day, we went down to Rotorua, saw this, you know, the geysers and the hot springs and whatever, and we came back to a place, the name of which escapes me right off the top of my tongue, but there was a kiwi orchard that we stopped at, and there was a little Robertson 44 four-seater parked out on the helipad in the front lawn. And we said, what's the deal with the chopper? And they went, oh, there's a bloke who lives just down the road who does flights. And he said, how many of you are there? And we said, three. And he said, well, that's good because it's a four-seater and you can't fly.
You do need a pilot.
Yeah. And he charged us $200 for the three of us. And that was a half-hour flight. And he took us out over the orchards and out over the ocean and, yeah, all around the place.
Well, this half-hour involved going over two glaciers, landing on the glacier.
Wow.
Going over the glacier. The weather there is pretty poor, so they can only go when they can go, and it's a limited market, so I guess they're taking advantage of it.
Yeah, right.
And what was fantastic is that there were four choppers at once.
Wow.
So got this almost Apocalypse Now photograph here. We were the last chopper, so I've got the three choppers
in the
distance about to go down the glacier.
Did they play Ride of the Valkyries through your headset?
It's going through my mind.
Nice.
Yes, only it's the smell of avgas.
Yeah, there you go. I love the smell of avgas in the morning. Nice. Carl Hemmings also sent us a link through the week, and this was to a blog post on David Dushman's site. Explaining that it has been 5 years already since he had his accident. I cannot believe that was 5 years ago. But then when I think about it, I think, oh, yeah, we just moved out of Sydney and up to the Central Coast when I remember hearing about it. I don't remember where he was. I remember he fell off a wall and fell something like 10 metres onto bricks and broke his back or something pretty nasty. And, it's been 5 years. I
didn't realize it was that long.
Yeah, so
I remember you talking about it on the show, and it's stunning how quickly we sort of forget. So
how quickly the years fly by. So anyway, that link is to episode 69 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast, where they obviously have a chat with David. So, if anyone wants to check that out, link will be in the show notes. And then we move on to your list of stuff. Do you want to take us through what you found this week, David?
Well, I'd like to wish everybody. This comes out. This is on Sunday. Yeah, this comes out on Sunday, but you've just missed out on World Wet Plate Day,
right?
2016. The website will be in the notes. Yeah. But what it is a group of enthusiasts that are doing wet plate colliding. I can't pronounce it correctly. Someone will correct me. Photography. It was one of the early forms. It was before dry plate photography, but it was the method before that. It's a classic method where you've got a glass plate, you set up your camera, you get your glass plate, and in a dark room you coat it with a wet mixture. You then take it in the dark to the camera, put it in the camera, expose the plate, and then in the dark take the plate back and develop the glass negative. And it all had to be done fairly quick, and the mixture had to be kept wet. So you get those classic pictures.
So if the plate is wet, and presumably the plate has to be vertical during the exposure, how does all the wet stuff not run off?
The wet stuff, I think, is more a granular mix.
Is it like a thick gel?
Yeah, it's a gel. Gunpowder was part of the process.
Right.
But it's a very on-the-spot thing. You have to do it on the spot. It's that classic thing you see Wild West movies where the photographer's got a wagon because you'd have to develop straight away. You had to do that with dry plate, but with wet plate, you know, you needed water and other things.
Yeah, right.
And that was of the era where other methods, and I'm not sure whether this method used mercuric oxide. So they talk about hatters being mad, and that's because they used mercuric oxide to make the brims of hats stiff.
Right.
And you can get acquired insanity through
bringing
up too much mercury, and photographers had the same problem.
Is that right?
But the site there, www.wetplate.org, has got some galleries of the previous years, and some of the photos are quite fascinating.
Yeah, right.
So people have applied the old technique to new scenes or people wearing modern clothes, and it really makes you sit up and think, well, you know, people in those days weren't living in black and white.
No.
You know, so it's contemporary photos done with the old method, and some of it's quite fuzzy. Yeah. There's one in the 2014 that's fascinating, or the 2014 collection, which is an Asian lady with a long ponytail. It's a nude, but the point is only her face is in focus. Nothing else is in focus.
Right.
And so the camera has a very narrow field of view in terms of keeping in focus, or the lens was made where it was, you know, only had a very narrow
depth of field. Yep.
Yeah, depth of field. So there's things like that. So all these photos have been taken recently, but there's quite a collection. They also allow for color types, which is sort of that's the forerunner of blueprints.
Oh, okay.
That type of photography. And anyone that wants to do daguerreotypes or tin types is also part of this group. But there's quite a gallery, and I actually found it quite fascinating.
Yeah,
so
right.
Happy Wet Plate Day.
Yeah. You know what I do love about the wet plate stuff is just the edges of the photos.
Oh, yeah.
They are awesome. It's the kind of stuff people pay money for to have a plug-in to do that kind of thing, and it just looks great.
It does. They are really fabulous, I think. It's just
You've just got different levels of exposure from, you know, things that have been near the edge of the frame, and it just, they're just so random in their the borders around the images are just great.
Yeah, it. It's just terrific. So yeah, it's
cool.
It's well worth. I thought that was quite a neat little piece I just accidentally came across.
Yeah, nice.
So yeah, there's a lot of people wanting to keep the old methods live.
Yeah, definitely. All right, what else have we got?
Well, I found there's a few exhibitions going on, particularly up your way at the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
There's
head-ons on at the moment, I think.
Yeah, it's part of that, I think.
Oh, yeah, you've got something in there for head-on. I can see it further down the list, yeah.
Further down? Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, look, the one I had first up here is one called In the Skin.
Right.
It was an ABC, it was on the ABC News. And it's a photographer, Natalie McComas, has put up an exhibition of people who've got birthmarks.
Oh, okay.
And it's a display of her photographs of different people with different birthmarks. And, again, it's quite fascinating.
Yeah, right.
I mean, her aim is to sort of say, it's to normalise it in the wider audience, you know.
Yeah.
From kids at school and that, they've got a birthmark, they're very self-conscious.
Yeah. Or,
you know, people have a second look at them. And this is to try and break that up. And, again, she's got a wide range of photos there. And I just find that an interesting concept to try and normalise something like that.
Yeah.
That some people get very worried about.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, there's some very interesting birthmarks on some of the people she's photographed.
Yeah. I mean, there's a photograph there of twins and one has no birthmark and the other does. So
yeah.
I wonder how that is, you know, it must be a real struggle for them to do it because, you know, she's got an identical twin sister.
Yeah.
And that would make it very difficult for her. So I think that's where I think photography can be very, very powerful in getting people to think about, you know, those sorts of issues.
Definitely. The In the Skin exhibition will be on display as part of the Head On Photography Festival in Sydney until May 15. So link will be in the show notes for anyone that wants to check that out. But, yeah.
And the second thing I had was also another exhibition, which is a type of photography that's always fascinated me. It's called Altered Lands.
Right.
And that's, again, in Sydney at the Customs House until June the 5th.
Okay.
And it's aerial photographs looking at the patterns of the landscape.
Oh, nice.
Particularly where man has intervened. And
yep.
It's Holen, McCook and Pettit.
Right.
And a couple of them are actually, they've obviously chartered a plane together.
Yeah.
But they've got slightly different views of, in some places, some similar places. And, again, it's just patterns that they've...
some of these are just amazing.
Oh, they are. There's one there that looks like Chinese characters.
Oh, okay. I obviously haven't got that far down yet.
No, it's about the... Well, it's actually the third one.
Oh, yes, right.
Yeah, see how the first photograph is the one by Paul Holen?
Yeah.
When you go to the third photograph... And it's the same site but taken more vertically. And, again, it looks quite different.
Right. So it's the same spot.
Well, it looks like the same spot. The patterning there looks similar. And if you have a flick back up, it's...
Oh, I see the first spot. The first image was the little one
little
up the
tiny
top. Right. Sorry, I was looking at the next one.
Oh, no.
But, yeah. Right, now I'm with you. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. It does look like characters from another written language, doesn't it? Or a bit hieroglyph-like.
Yeah, exactly.
But I love the one below it, which is just these some weird, you know, reds and then some sort of greys and what look like, you know, it looks like just a close-up of an oil painting.
Yeah.
You know, like these splashes of gold plate.
What's the other? Yeah.
Sorry?
It bleeds from one colour to the other.
Yeah. It just gorgeous. The land is... so amazing from the air.
Yeah.
Oh, love the reds and pinks of the evaporation ponds.
Oh, yes.
A bit further down.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yes, I've got that one.
Oh, and then two beyond that is obviously that same location again from the first couple of images.
Yep.
Wow. Oh, wow. Alex, there's some great images there.
It's fascinating. So...
yeah,
I think it's probably a good opportunity to go down and have a look. And
yeah, definitely check out the link, people. There's some beautiful aerial photography in that lot. All right, what do we got next?
The next one that caught my eye was it was one about a guy who's really into microscopic macros.
Right.
And this is actually a small video. it's called a photographer turned thousands of photos and weeks of work into incredible insect images. So he's a professional photographer, commercial photographer.
Right.
But for a bit of a hobby, he gets insects, and he's got a works with the Oxford Museum.
Yeah.
It's got one of the biggest insect collections in Britain.
Right.
He gets to take home an insect, and after about 3 weeks, he returns it and has produced a photo. He mounts the photo, the camera, through a microscope and lights it very carefully. So he's mounting it actually horizontally and moves the camera or the lens system forward 10 microns for every shot.
What? Now,
to give you an idea, your hair is about 27 microns. Fine wool is about 15 to 19 microns. So
wow.
He gets an insect, and so he just does photo after photo, takes 2 to 3 weeks to do that, process the image, but they can be blown up into giant posters.
Wow.
Just amazing posters. So there's an exhibition, there's advertisers, but the posters are wall size and the detail is immaculate. The scientists are using his photos to understand the insects more as well.
Yeah, right.
Just something completely different.
Wow.
So there's just a little, about a 5-minute video on it, and I think he's doing a great job. Levon Biss
is his name. Wow, I'll have to have a look at that video. That sounds absolutely fascinating, because it's funny that you should bring this up, because being in this neck of the woods, I'm a member of a Facebook group, Hunter Valley, I think it might just be Hunter Valley Photographers Group, and there's somebody on that group who posts photos of, you know, macros of insects that once again have been focus stacked from multiple images. So I don't think she's doing them 10 microns apart or anything, but the results that she's getting are absolutely mind-blowing. So I will definitely watch that video. That sounds fascinating.
If you scroll down, there's a photograph of him with his rig.
Yeah.
You got that tiny little insect there. Well, that's actually a fairly large one in that case.
Yeah, but, yeah.
So I don't
understand how you would focus stack images where the point of focus has only moved 10 microns. That's just crazy.
He must have been doing it at f naught point something.
Yeah.
To be able to do that. It just amazes me.
I would have thought that with macro stuff, no, you'd have to be shutting the aperture right down to really small values to get any depth of field. I don't know if you've ever done any macro stuff.
But no, I've not done it myself.
If you can try and shoot at f11 and, you know, it's like taking a portrait at f1.8, you know, because the aperture or your depth of field gets shallower and shallower the closer you get to your subject. And so, yeah, you find that with macro stuff, you've really got to shut down, which means you've got to have a really good light source. Yeah, no, I can't wait to watch that video. That'll be very interesting.
Well, the photo of his rig shows he puts a lot of effort into lighting.
Yeah.
And getting that right. The little bug on a – looks like a wad of gum mounted on a
– on a tiny little clamp of some sort.
Yeah, that's right. quite astounding.
Excellent.
But the other one I sort of spotted, that, again, it's another little video. It's just a fascinating thing, was how they make ink.
Oh, okay.
And it's, again, it was from Popular Photography, but it was just saying the process of making printing ink is wonderfully mesmerizing.
Yeah, right.
When you see it, they're basically putting a powder into a carrier liquid. But the powder's got to be absolutely, you know, refined. It's got to be even. It's got to be ground down. And in its liquid form, it's ground down several times.
Right.
So it's actually quite fascinating to see how much effort goes into the making of ink, something we just chuck in our printers or we see on a magazine, and we just, you know, you buy the colour if you're going to use it, and you just automatically think, oh, well, it's just ink, you know. the way they put it together to be consistent and all that is quite a challenge. Another little 5-minute video.
I'd never really given that much consideration, but yeah, I guess, you know, if they're taking powder and just mixing it with, as you say, a carrier liquid, then obviously the quantity of powder and the purity of the powder would have to be absolutely spot on, certainly for consistency, because, you know, you get people who want to print with absolute certainty that, you know, the colour that comes out is absolutely spot on for what they're expecting.
Yep.
You know, and with the, you know, level or degree of accuracy that things like the Pantone colour system allow, then inks obviously have to match that for consistency. So, yeah, that would be very challenging, I would imagine.
Yeah, and the firm that they cover does, you know, CMYK inks, but then they will make custom covers, sorry, custom colours,
yeah,
for Pantone colours for people as they require.
Yeah, right.
So it's I think it's quite an amazing little piece of work. Now I'm fascinated. I want to know how they get the pigment so even to start with.
Yeah.
So the, you know, these guys buy in the pigment and work that through. Well, how do you get the pigment in the first place? So that, yeah, you know, I'm going to have a look around for that because it's got me fascinated.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know what sort of source materials they're using for the pigments.
That's right.
You know, if they're plant-based, how do seasonal changes, weather changes or whatever influence the colours produced by the flowers? Because you would imagine that different amounts of water in a season might, you know, influence how much colour a plant generates when it flowers. If they're using, you know, plants for pigments, if they're animal-based pigments, then presumably similar concerns come into play. You know, how well fed was it? How well watered was it? You know, was it undercover? Did it live out in the open? How consistent was its environment from year to year? You know, all these things would come into play, I would imagine.
And even mineral-based.
Yeah.
About consistency of the vein of mineral that you're working with and that type of thing. But, you know, I've got a bit to do with agriculture and yeah, trying to get that consistency of product is a huge challenge.
I can imagine. I mean, I remember going up to Lightning Ridge a few years ago with Max and, you know, we did one or two tours through opal mines and they talked about the differences in opal. Even within a small geographical region, you know, the differences in the types of opal being mined can be quite significant. And certainly between one location like Lightning Ridge and another location like White Cliffs, which is, you know, 500 Ks away, you get completely different types of opal. So I would imagine that, you know, for other mineral type, you know, mining processes that, you know, you're talking about minerals being a source material for these pigments, you can imagine that, you know, even digging up a particular mineral at one point on the planet, digging it up somewhere else, it could be a completely different shade of, you know, that colour.
But a good example, if you're ever in Ballarat, the opposite Sovereign Hill is the Gold Museum. And there is a collection of a gentleman who collected gold over a period of time by panning and had different flaky gold, nuggety gold, all these different golds from different creeks had different shape. You know, when it's all heated and, you know, put into an ingot, it becomes uniform. But to see it in its form that it was got out of the ground or panned out is quite interesting. It's quite a neat little display and it shows it's something that you think like gold, well, it can come in all different forms and shapes.
So despite its different shapes, is the colour consistent?
Yes, although you can get a little bit more red depending on where it comes from. But there's about 30 or 40 little samples with the different creeks around Ballarat. And it's the old, you know, push a button, the light lights up on the map where it is. But it's quite interesting because you come away with a different view of what even something like gold is. So,
although when I think about it, gold being an element of the periodic table, any impurity of colour would have to be an impurity of the actual element, wouldn't it?
That's right. But then the shape is quite interesting, how it's flaky in some spots and in other places it's got that sort of nuggety bit to it, and in some places it's more rounded. So talk about the mother lode being at the creek and it's washed down and it depends how long, you know, it's gone through – you know, the streams and that over thousands of years and how it's and how it's tumbled down the creek. Yep. But some creeks have distinctive types of gold. So
yeah, right.
So yeah, how they get that consistency? That's my next little interesting voyage.
Cool. So the next one you had was off DP Review.
Yeah, about Canon's profits plunging.
Jeez.
And it's very interesting that they're saying that, and I notice how we don't have SLRs anymore. We've got ILCs. It seems to be the new three-letter acronym. Right. Interchangeable lens cameras.
Right.
Basically, they're saying that Canon Japan is saying that their ILC unit sales are one of the bright points.
Yeah, right.
Even though they are flat, they were bright compared to their other, 17.5% fall in income in the first quarter.
But that's in their interchangeable lens division. Reported flat ILC unit sales as one of the bright points in first quarter reports that saw a 17.5% fall in net income.
Yeah.
So they're saying that was the best thing that they had to talk about.
That's right.
And that's net income.
They're blaming, you know, strengthening yen, but poor performance in laser printing.
What?
And compact cameras are getting a caning.
Yeah, right.
So it's that march of the iPhone.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, every day you're hearing of, you know, some new smartphone that's about to hit the market and constantly hearing, you know, glowing reports of how much better the cameras are getting
in the
various smartphones, you know. I still think the weak point in phones is the lenses, but, you know, they're getting so damn good now.
They're starting to pick up their quality. Just reading this article a bit further, it says that a 22% decline in the compact camera market.
Ouch.
So the 80D has been a bit of a rescue because it's been selling very strongly.
Right.
And the M3 is doing all right.
Okay.
It's interesting, though, that cameras are about 84% of the company's revenue.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That's not a healthy sounding company.
No. the person who's got Canon gear, I hope the next one that comes out is better, because it seemed that the 80D seemed to have a few things in it that people have been wanting for a while, but it's part of that discussion we had last time where the mirrorless market and the Sonys of the world are coming up with new ideas, yet Nikon and Canon seem to be a bit pedestrian.
Yeah. I was a little surprised to see you mention mirrorless cameras in this story. I didn't realise that Canon had actually gone into the mirrorless market.
It mentions here the M3 and M10, but it looks like it's Asia is the main market for them.
Right.
Yeah, because we don't normally associate Canon with mirrorless. You know, we more associate Fuji and Sony and others.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm just pulling up a web page to have a look at the EOS M3. So it's an interchangeable lens, or is it a...
Well, just as they're mirrorless cameras, but I would say...
Is the lens interchangeable, or are they...
No idea. I don't know.
Yeah, right.
If you're a hardliner, I notice at the bottom of bottom of the article, you can pull up you can have a look at the Canon Quarter 1 2016 financial statement. Yeah. Go for your life.
Make sure you're sitting down when you read that one. Jeez.
With a soft chair. And
yeah, absolutely.
The head's not. Yeah. The other one I had, though, speaking of all that, was Leica with an LCD. Free.
So a camera with no LCD.
Yeah. Digital camera, which I thought, well, that's an interesting market move.
Yeah.
By Leica. And it's seen as a camera for photographers with a love of simplicity and a dislike of chimping.
Nice.
Desire to live in the past and the future simultaneously. I like the market hype on these.
Yeah.
I will be really interested to know the price compared to the other Leicas. It's sort of Leica has got a pretty heavy price tag.
They're the Apple of the photography world, aren't they? It's like you're buying the name.
Very much. And I must admit...
And I'm not dissing their product, because I've never shot with a Leica camera. I wouldn't know how good or how bad they are, but they just strike me as the type of company who have done a fantastic job of marketing their name and positioning themselves as a premium product, and have managed to convince people to pay an arm and a leg for a product that you could get for a tenth of the price elsewhere.
And they have maintained that position for a long time.
Yeah.
Well, they introduced 35mm film.
Is that right?
Well, Leica was originally it's a light company. 35mm film was originally movie film. Back in the early 1900s. It was used for, you know, the old silent movies and that. And Leica used to make light meters.
Right.
And so the first Leica was based on the size of their light meter and also on 35mm film, because that was what movies were made with. And so that's how we got 35mm film as being a general standard. It came actually from Leica.
Wow.
So, which I found quite fascinating. And then you need, you know, people like Cartier-Bresson and a few others like that using them.
Right.
And getting spectacular shots, and sort of away they go.
Yep.
But it's interesting, because the one thing I think people have got to be wary of is that buying a camera like that doesn't automatically make you a good photographer.
Oh, hell no.
I think some people think that.
Yeah. For those who are interested, $5,995, and it's all yours.
It's a snip.
Sports photographers need not apply, because in continuous mode, this will rattle off frames at a blistering 3 frames per second.
Oh, wow.
So you probably don't want to be shooting sport with this thing.
Well, it's really anticipating the moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's right. Why I had to invent that.
Yeah.
The other one I had here in the sort of a group of new gadgets was Sony patenting a contact lens camera with a blink-triggered shutter.
I've seen this once or twice this week, and I never got around to actually looking at any of the articles that I saw. I saw it pop up on my Facebook feed a couple of times. Yeah. So have you had a chance to read this?
I've just had a very short read, but I had to make sure that it wasn't labelled April the 1st.
Right. Yeah.
But the potential that it opens up could be, might not even be as a camera, might be, I thought, as a remote trigger.
Right. Right.
But yeah, it's apparently triggered by conscious eyelid aperture and closure.
Wow.
So as some sensor measures the pressure of your eyelid, and other settings such as aperture and zoom can be controlled via eyelid movement as well. Yeah, I'll see it before I believe it.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea is interesting, but
it would be absolutely mind-blowing if it focused where your eye was focused.
Yes.
And presumably that's what they're aiming for. I mean, it'd be a bit pointless if it didn't.
But how would it cope if you're a person who needs a contact lens anyway and needs lens correction?
Yeah. Well, maybe, like, you know, your DSLR has a diopter adjustment on the viewfinder. Maybe they can incorporate all of that electronically, you know, compensation.
Yeah, that sounds, well, if they can do all this, why not?
Exactly. I'm thinking if you can build a camera that's going to sit over my eye and not obscure my field of vision, then probably, you know, dialing in a little bit of compensation for my long-sightedness or short-sightedness or whatever is probably not that great a stretch.
I wonder if they come in different colours, like some, or that we can get an etching of a tiger on it or something like that as well. You know?
Yeah.
Or an etching of a camera.
You know, have coloured filters on it. So it can make your eyes look different colours.
It could be quite, quite interesting.
Yeah, well, watch this space.
Yeah. I think that's basically mostly what I had there, Bruce.
Okay. Not going to cover the Calvin Klein thing?
Well,
I don't know the story.
I don't know the full story, but I heard a little bit about it. And the story is, there's a Melbourne photographer that is taking Calvin Klein to court over an advertisement of theirs.
Right.
If you see it, it's a girl who's amongst a pile of denim.
Yep. She's lying naked on a pile of denim and there's some strategically placed clothes to cover her up.
Yep.
Yep.
That's right. And this apparently is a scene in an advert, so it's from a movie. But further down is you'll see another picture that was his that looks very similar. Now, the question becomes, has Calvin Klein actually stolen his idea, or have they been inspired by him, or have they come up with it independently? This is becoming sort of an increasing issue by some people and similar photo shoots and things like that.
Right.
And I guess it raises that whole issue about copyright in photos and what's imitation and what's not. What's a direct ripoff? It's quite different to that guy that was using other people's Facebook photos or whatever it was and making separate art out of them.
Richard Prince, I think his name was.
That's right.
Yeah.
This is sort of someone's producing a photo that looks very close
similar.
To mine.
Yep.
Similar to mine. They're ripping me off. It's something I think that would be very hard to establish. And we're all influenced by other photographers. How many people have gone and looked at
for sure.
photos of Calvin Klein or even the exhibitions we've just talked about today? You could go to one of those and get inspired to take an essence of that and take it forward. And so I would think it would be very difficult to establish this, and it would become very difficult for us as photographers to operate.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you mention that, because only today I was talking to somebody while I was at work about the cultural differences in China towards copying somebody else's work, and how, you know, in the Chinese culture, if you can produce a copy of another artist's work to a degree that the copy is indistinguishable from the original piece of artwork, then you are considered to be as talented an artist as the artist you ripped off.
Yeah.
Now, I personally don't subscribe to that, because as a person who's copied somebody else's art, you haven't necessarily created something from scratch. You didn't come up with the idea. You saw somebody else's idea and you replicated it.
Mm.
But be that as it may, that's a very cultural thing within China. And the person I was having this discussion with was saying about how some company had come out with cases for iPhones and had used the phrase iPhone in the name of the product. And Apple tried to take them to court. And it was a Chinese company. And the Chinese court just went, yeah, chucked it out. Said, no, you haven't got a leg to stand on in China. As far as we're concerned, this is perfectly valid. Even though they've used the word iPhone, which, you know, presumably Apple has copyrighted that, or trademarked that, sorry, more precise. As far as Chinese law is concerned, that's not a valid claim. And so you kind of think, well, you know, at what point is that point of view justified, and at what point is it not justified? And this is somewhere along that slippery slope. I don't think it's as far an extreme as where China is at with regards its disregard of copyright, but it's certainly along that slippery slope.
You don't know where it stops, but then as photographers, we have a technique called Rembrandt lighting.
Yeah, that's right.
So for every time that's been used, we're paying the royalties to Rembrandt's family.
Yeah.
You know, a million times a day.
Yeah.
The technique must be being used.
Yeah.
So at what point? And I mean, actually, I can remember a series Glyn did, which was making things looking like an old oil painting.
Right.
Photos. And they were fantastic. They looked in the style of.
Yeah, definitely.
And there's that subtlety. Is it in the style of, or is it a direct ripoff? Or as they did in some of the painting masters places, they taught the young artists by mimicking the master and then taking it further.
Yeah.
So it was often seen as a step on the way to follow what the master did. And, of course, when they themselves ended their apprenticeship, they did one big painting, and that was called, of course, their masterpiece, which is their right. – it's just like submitting your master's thesis.
All right.
Was the equivalent. That's where the term comes from.
Right.
So, you know, it's this is one of those things that it raises that issue, but quite often you can have an array of photographers at a workshop.
Yep.
And you've got the one model to shoot and you've done it yourself. Everyone will take a shot, but it'll be a bit different.
Yeah, definitely.
And it can the differences may be only very subtle, but they can make a big difference to what the final image looks like. And
yeah,
you know, I just put this one up to just raise the issue and do some thinking about it. And as some say, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
Yeah, it just doesn't pay the bills.
Exactly. And I guess that's the issue when there's money on the line.
Yeah.
So I just thought it was an interesting issue.
Cool. All right. So what do you got coming up?
Oh, I'm got an interesting month towards the end of the month. Looking forward to it with some trepidation. I've got a workshop with Glyn.
Oh, cool.
A TTL flash workshop with him.
Nice.
Like you, I'm mainly a manual flash person.
Yep.
And I actually did a couple of workshops with Glyn and can only endorse your words. He's great to have a session with because you learn so much.
Yeah,
through a lot of laughter.
Yes,
I think that's what opens up your thinking and opens up your mind.
Definitely, definitely.
The other one I've got coming up is an interesting one. I'm giving a talk to a local group about just some photos I've taken, mainly of the Grampians, and I did a trip to Tasmania. But I'm learning you can have some unexpected outcomes of doing that.
Of what?
Of just making yourself available to to talk about photos. It's a retirement home that I'm giving the talk to, and a little poster's gone out saying David Marlin's going to give a talk and all that. And the financial officer got a visit from one of the other people of the place and sent me the following email, which I think is worth listening to. Forgot to mention about my dilemma with X. Names have been removed to protect the guilty.
Right.
And by the way, none of them listen to this podcast.
Oh, okay.
Once he was aware that I was organising a photo presentation night with yourself of the Grampians in Tasmania, he thought I might like to do of him in Darwin. I now have wads of photos sitting on my desk of his wild pig shooting, wild Brumby skinning, complete with numerous shots of rotting carcasses. A rotting beached whale carcass, close up, beer-drinking pigs and beer-drinking lorikeets, along with numerous catches of fish, prawns, any underwater thingy, complete with toe-sucking, skinning, exfoliating sucker fish of Darwin, X driving up a sand dune and skidding down on a sand dune rather quickly on his ass, and one more, X dressing up as Santa Claus with extremely short shorts on. This sort of stuff is not in my job description. Trauma counselling sort. So talk about out of left field.
Yeah.
So after volunteering to help, I've got a feeling I'm going to have to take a bottle of red to keep the finance officer sane. never know what can turn up and what people might consider as good photography.
Yeah.
So, what about yourself? What have you got?
Nothing immediately, but I have got a week off coming up in July, so it's still a couple of months away now, but Kath and I have booked a holiday rental house up at Southwest Rocks.
All right.
So we're looking forward to that. It's just going to be a week to get away and just lay low, not do much. So I'll be taking the camera with me and, you know, hopefully get out for a couple of mornings and do some sunsets and some landscape stuff. And
if you're permitted.
Kath's very supportive of that sort of stuff. So, so it's not that. It's about me wanting to get out of bed at stupid o'clock when I'm on holiday. but hopefully just, you know, get out and do a bit of landscape stuff, which I haven't done much of lately. And, so I'm sort of looking forward to that. So.
Look, it's good to be out in the bush and by the sea, you know, just being part of the place and then trying to capture the essence of it.
Yeah.
I think that's a lovely challenge. We once a year in Queen's Birthday weekend go to Beachport in South Australia.
Right.
And it's got a few good opportunities. So the challenge now is to do something a bit different there each time. And I just find that very refreshing as well. So,
I think there's always the whole the grass is greener on the other side aspect of going somewhere that you don't normally go, or somewhere that you've never been before, you know, just getting out of your comfort zone, you know. I'm sure within 10Ks of where you live, you're probably sick of seeing all of it. Would I be correct or not?
Yes and no, because I keep reflecting on, say, Ansel Adams, who lived in Yosemite for all those years.
Yeah, right.
And when you look at some of those photographers that produced stuff like that, they lived there.
Yeah.
And so they had the opportunity of going, the wind's in the northwest today.
Yeah.
And off they go to us. They know where to go to. So they knew the area.
How to capitalize on every nuance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I must admit, within 10Ks, there's a few things, but a bit further afield was pretty good.
Yeah, right.
Around here.
But I think of, you know, my particular pocket of the Central Coast, and I think, there's nothing here that inspires me, you know. But you take me out of here and drop me anywhere that's, you know, more than a couple of hundred kilometres from here, and I'll be happy as, because it's all something, it's all different, and it's, you know, a different landscape, and it's, you know, everything's different.
Well, we tend to look at it with new eyes.
Yeah.
And it sort of freshens us up.
Yeah. Like I said, you know, grass is always greener on the other side.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Oh, well.
So I'm looking forward to that. Well, mate, thank you very much for putting your hand up this week.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no worries.
I like our little community of six or seven having met you over there.
So if anyone else would like to put their hand up and come and be a guest host next week, please sing out, drop me an email, whatever. Love to hear from you.
It's not painful, guys, girls.
Well, we try not to be.
Well, as Rob said last week, it's just like a conversation.
Yeah, well, that's the aim. So, yeah. All right, mate, well, you have a good one.
Thank you very much, and yourself.
And we'll talk with you again soon.
No worries. Cheers.
See ya.
ShutterZincPodcast.com.
AnotherAudioTo.com quality podcast.
For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@ShutterZincPodcast.com.